I'm very pleased to welcome to Fremantle Shipping News, Sophie McNeil. Welcome, Sophie.
Hi, good morning.
Well, here we are in beautiful Fremantle this morning. Lots of dramas around the place. A big container ship has crashed into the Lewin training vessel in the harbour this morning, which has got every journalist in town out and about.
Oh, dear. No, poor Lewin.
Poor Lewin. But in the day, when you were at the height of your journalistic powers, you must have had days like that where suddenly you're perhaps somewhere in Palestine or Israel or Afghanistan or somewhere and you hear of some great drama.
I miss those days, you know, drop everything, jump on a plane, head to the spot. Yeah, it was a very exciting life.
Well, you had a stellar journalistic career, Walkley Awards, nominations, all sorts of prizes. It must have been sort of helter-skelter when you were at the height of it.
I still think being a journalist is the best job in the world, the best job I ever had. And, you know, in some ways I still am. I think you never stop being a journalist, telling stories. That is probably what I'm best at. But I guess, yeah, I'm just now choosing a different way to tell those stories because, yeah, for me, I guess I wanted to be a journalist to change the world. You know, that was the aim. And I got in there and, the change just didn't happen as quick as I wanted. And I'd be standing there shouting at all these terrible disasters and wanting people to care and wanting policy to change. And it became quite frustrating. So I decided, you know, I better put my money where my mouth was and just go and be one of the doers, you know, trying to directly change the policy itself. And I, again, tried a few different ways and now I'm ultimately ended up where, I'm going to politics.
Let's look at the sequence a little bit. I mean, I still have, obviously, a very young Sophie McNeil sitting here talking to me, but once upon a time there was a much younger Sophie McNeil. Say when you're finishing high school, do you have a dream about what you wanted to do then? What fired you up and why?
So I went to Hollywood High. I did a humanities program there and kind of grew up on the Freo train line because Mum was in Mount Hawthorne and Dad was in East Freo, so just would kind of go back and forth between Hollywood and my mum's house and my dad's house. And so Fremantle really has always been a big part of my life. Grew up in the Dockers cheer squad, which is, you know, people often said, how did you go to all those really traumatic places and witness all those horrible things? And I'd say, well, you know, I've been a Dockers supporter since day dot, so I'm very good at dealing with, you know, trauma. But I was year 9 at Hollywood High, entering year 10, and I read Hidden Agendas by the Australian journalist John Pilger. And I was blown away to find out about East Timor and what had happened there and was pretty horrified that here I was. You know, I thought I knew a bit. I'd always kind of been quite passionate about politics and world affairs. Not sure what led me to that, you know, but was just blown away by the fact that I didn't know about this, that we weren't taught this in school. You know, the fact that just an hour's flight north of Darwin, here was this place where, you know, a third of the population had been killed as a result of this illegal occupation by Indonesia that my government had greenlit, you know, that we were now had helped Indonesia take the profits of the oil out from under the seabed there. And you know, the absolute horrific abuses committed against the East Timorese by the Indonesian military. So I just read that, was just outraged that I didn't know, and then was like, now that I know, what am I going to do about it? And so I got involved in, you know, there's a great East Timorese community in Perth at the time that was campaigning for independence. You know, the UN had just started organising the vote to happen on the ground because it was 1999 when it happened. So yeah, I was 14. And
14?
Yeah.
They were, wow.
Oh, you know, I got bored easy. That's all, you know, I needed something to do. It was either that or get in trouble at school, which started to happen. So it was good. I stopped getting in trouble at school and put all my energy into the East Timorese independence movement and made amazing friends. And, you know, then the vote happened. And then, you know, we had 450 East Timorese refugees that were taken from the UN compound in Dili, where they were surrounded by Indonesian militia. And, you know, Australian forces airlifted them out and we had 450 come to Freo, stay at Lewin Barracks, just down the road from where my dad lived. So I used to go there every day after school and on the weekends and volunteer teaching English, helping look after the kids. And then, you know, all those refugees returned home. You know, at the height of the wet season, there was typhoid, malaria, dengue fever was rife, but the Australian government sent them home. And they all called me. There was, you know, free Telstra call time. and we would chat, and they would tell me about how terrible the conditions were there. And then I went up there, like I sold hundreds of chocolate Freddo frogs, and Burragoon Rotary Club gave me $1,000 for my airfares. Wow. After I wrote letters to every single Rotary Club in Perth, and Burragoon was the only one who responded.
Okay, good.
I had some amazing Vietnam veterans from Burragoon Rotary Club who backed me in, and I went up there and started making my own documentary films. You know, my plan to be like John Pilger. So it all began a very kind of, just a homemade effort that, I just fell in love with journalism at a very young age.
And that's what happened. So you then, by design, really decided to pursue a journalistic career. So where did that take you? Where did you go through formal journalism school?
Well, I didn't. So I think just kind of made it up as I went along, really. I finished year 12, at Shenton College, because Colin Barnett closed down Hollywood High. So that was always, very upsetting that happened. And I enrolled straight away, straight out of high school, to go to Curtin Uni and do politics, and did a minor in film so that I could borrow all their cameras, which are much better than my camera that I had. And I went up to Timor again to make a doco about how Australia was helping to steal, the oil in the Timor Sea, in the Timor Gap there. And they wrote an article about me in Curtin University news, kind of magazine. And a producer in Sydney at SBS read that article, and they were looking for shooters in WA.
Amazing.
And they needed, that we had these new mini DV cameras where you could make broadcast quality TV for a couple of $1,000. I knew how to use one. They were that desperate to find someone to work in WA that they just, they called Curtin and said, can we have the number of this girl?
That's an amazing student of yours.
Well,
except you weren't.
The uni called me and said, do you mind if we give your number to SBS? And I was like, give me their number. And then spoke to the producer, and he was like, are you ever in Sydney? And I was like, I'm going to be there in 2 weeks. Totally, lied. I just bought a ticket to Sydney and basically didn't come back for 17 years. Yeah.
So you got into journalism without being able to hold up a ticket from some accredited school of journalism.
Yeah, because this is, I think if you could tell a story and you care about things, it's something that's in your bones, So
I agree with you.
And I think almost that helped me with journalism, because I did it what felt right in my gut, in my heart and in my head, not rather than the way you're meant to do it. I think there's a lot of problems right now with the ABC and false equivalence and all of this bullshit, telling journalists they have to be robots and all of that. My journalism was always about caring about people and trying to make the world a better place,
So Pilger was obviously an influence, some sort of model for you to be brave and to go in and do it. Were there other good positive influences, if you can put it like that, that you modelled yourself on?
Well, I was really lucky, because when I arrived in Sydney at SBS, it was kind of this golden age of journalism at SBS Dateline. So this is, journalists like Mark Davis, Olivia Rousset, Bronwyn Adcock, amazing video journalists. So what happened again, they were getting rid of these big crew models and just giving journalists these small cameras and making observational films. And, Mark Davis was an amazing trendsetter in this area. And Mark had just won the Gold Walkley. He had, flown into Timor in the days after it'd been burnt to the ground, went to the Indonesian military headquarters and started rifling through, the burnt kind of filing cabinets, and found the documents that proved that the Indonesian government had funded these militias, and had planned this whole effort to burn the country to the ground after losing the vote. And Mark Davis had come to Perth to speak after winning the Gold Walkley, and I went to go see him and said, I want to be just like you when I grow up. So when I walked into SBS, only, less than a year later, Mark was like, you're that kid from Perth. And so, these were amazing times. Olivia Rousset, who's also from Perth, she'd won Race Around the World a few years earlier. And Olivia, broke the Abu Ghraib photos, the second photo scandal. That was broken by SBS Dateline, that big global story. And I was,
incredible.
I'd been in the US at the time and had to go and get on a train for Olivia and go pick up a CD of photos from somewhere, it was amazing days. It was, the Iraq War. I was in the SBS newsroom as the Iraq War happened, and my mind was absolutely just, devastated to see this horror unfolding, and the way that you know, that, that conflict played out and the deaths of so many innocent Iraqis for something that we knew was based on a lie. So I grew up in the SBS newsroom. You literally, I rocked up there at 18 and I had these amazing people all around me that I just used to sit there and just watch them and learn and just be like, please send me somewhere, send me somewhere, 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 send me somewhere. And like they kept on lobbing it. It was really funny. Like I was got kicked out of my share house because they were selling it in Sydney, and so I went and go live at the Bondi Backpackers for a bit. And all of the journalists, I kept on asking the EP of Dateline, because I'd just been working on national stuff, Australian stories, and I kept saying, please send me somewhere, Mike, you know, Mike Carey, his name.
Yeah, my life is in danger.
Oh, well, I just, you know, I was begging him, and all the other journalists were lobbying for me, saying, oh, come on, Mike Soap's living at the Backpackers, you know, send us somewhere. And I wanted to go to the Middle East, and he's like, you're too young to go there, because I was, you know, like 19. And but then he, my first trip, he didn't want to send me anywhere dangerous, but I landed in Detroit at 3 a.m.
Well, that can be a dangerous place.
Well, I'd never been to America, and I was doing a story about the first Iraqi war veteran, first American Iraqi war soldier to refuse further service in Iraq. So he had gone there, he was a sniper in Al Ramadi. This guy was a vegetarian. His parents were Nicaraguan Sandinistas. He'd only enrolled in the Florida National Guard because he wanted to pay for his college tuition. And then suddenly he got sent to the, you know, Al Ramadi in Iraq and was, you know, told to shoot, you know, innocent Iraqis. And so he came back on leave to America and just decided he was going to refuse to serve. And then they sent him to jail for a year. He served a year at Fort Bragg, you know. Camilo Mejia was his name. That was the first story I did for SBS overseas. And yeah, it started off at 3 a.m. in Detroit, which I managed to survive. And then, yeah.
Well, that was a Middle Eastern story after all.
Well, that was it. They wouldn't send me to the Middle East, Michael, but I did every story I could about the Middle East from outside the Middle East before they sent me there, so, yeah.
You finish up at the ABC.
I did, yeah.
How did that transition happen?
So, I mean, SBS was great because, like, literally, it was a shoestring, you know. Like, we had to pay for our own hotels. It was, you know, I worked there for seven years and... yeah, it was a labour of love, but, you know, the best place you could do the most cutting-edge journalism in Australia at the time. And, yeah, and then I came back to Australia, actually had my first baby when I was 25, Nat, who's now, God, he's a 13-year-old, which is hard to believe. But, yeah, I was offered a job at ABC, at Triple J, to present Hack, which was definitely the coolest job I ever had. And I got to Triple J and I was still just the nerd reading the newspaper in the corner. So I didn't last too long at Triple J because the Syrian revolution was happening, you know. The Middle East was exploding and I wanted to be there and do those stories. And they kept wanting me to talk about sex and synthetic marijuana and I just wanted to talk about Syria. So, yeah, I didn't stay too long at Triple J and then was lucky enough to get a gig at Foreign Correspondent at ABC. So, yeah, that was I was very pleased to leave Triple J.
For many years, as I've got older, I watch less and less television. Foreign Correspondent was my weekly treat when it was showing. Magnificently produced. I felt as if I was on the ground wherever the Foreign Correspondent was. The quality of the film was superb and the reporting was amazing. Must have been something special to work on.
It was wonderful. You know, it really was. It was such a dream to go from SBS where you had to, like, film it yourself, produce it yourself, you know, do everything yourself, and then suddenly I was working with award-winning cinematographers. So it was, you know, all I had to do was like ask the questions. I was like, what, this is easy compared to having to film it. We got to tell some amazing stories and go to some wonderful places. My dream was to be the Middle East correspondent. That was always the dream. And I was.
And that happened.
It did, yeah.
And where were you based?
So in 2015, moved over there with the whole family. So by that stage, I had a 4-year-old and a 2-year-old, and my husband Ruben, who's wonderful, and he spent the time looking after the kids because I would just have to run off, you know, get on a plane at a moment's notice. When we arrived in Jerusalem in 2015, the region was on fire. You know, there'd just been another horrific war waged on Gaza. There had been, you know, the Syria war was in its third, fourth year, and the Russians had just entered to aid President Assad in massacring his own people, you know, the Russian AirPal was having a devastating impact on civilians in throughout Syria. We had ISIS was just beginning to emerge, you know, was horrific treatment of civilians all over that, you know, kind of Western Iraq and Northern Syria, and that was absolutely devastating. And Saudi Arabia had just started bombing Yemen, you know, the richest country in the region, bombing the poorest. So everywhere you looked, there was just massacres and war crimes and, you know, using starvation as a weapon of war. We saw that. The Saudis were doing that to the Yemenis.
Mm.
President Assad was doing that to his own people in parts of Syria. And, you know, yeah, we're seeing that today, now, right now in Gaza, because no one cared about it back then. So it was a really, yeah, it was a really mad time in the region. Yeah, kind of nonstop.
It just amazes me how you can handle this subject matter. Because it's not intellectual, it's not remote. You become involved in it. How do you, is there some way that you physically prepare yourself for it, or is it just this drive to be the journalist who tells this important story? And you somehow deal with all of the trauma?
So I guess my way of dealing with it was always to do something about it. You know, there's no use just kind of tearing your hair out. You know, so journalism was always my way of doing something about it. So it was like, yeah, it was a superpower to be a journalist, you know, particularly like a white, privileged Western woman. You know, I could go anywhere. You know, I was treated as an honorary man. I got into places that women weren't allowed to go in the Middle East. But, you know, I got to hang out with the women and children in many ways that male correspondents couldn't. So I really had access everywhere. You know, I could go into Gaza anytime I wanted. I had the journalist stamp. You know, Palestinians from the West Bank could not go and see their families in Gaza. They were totally banned. People in Gaza were banned from leaving, despite the fact that they had kids who were, you know, with cancer, or they were suffering from breast cancer. I did dozens of stories documenting how the Israelis used to block medical care for Palestinians. So, you know, I could go through any checkpoint I wanted. I had this, you know, I was so privileged. And so it was like, wow, you know, like you'd never felt sorry for yourself or scared. Like, and I actually think it's good for journalists to feel scared. You know, you would meet out on the road, kind of often they were Americans and they would love wearing their flak jacket and they'd always go hang out in bed with the military and, you know, they'd love those stories. Whereas I always wanted to hang back and hang out with the women and children who were fleeing somewhere, you know, not be with the macho kind of men sitting around with their guns. So yeah, it was just, I was the privileged one and I had a job to do. And what drove me was this belief that by telling these stories, things would change. And that only went so far, because when I, you know, I finished that posting and we came home in 2018, you know, the kids had never kind of spent any time with family and we wanted them to know what Australia was. And I sat down to write a book about my time there, called We Can't Say We Didn't Know. And, you know, I realized like how much I had reported on all this horror that we had captured and filmed, and that the Syrians themselves, you know, had risked their lives and lost their lives to show people what was happening to them. The same with the Yemenis and the Palestinians, and nothing changed. And that's when I kind of lost that belief in me that if I told people, things would get better. And then I realized, unfortunately, today in this world, we're so overwhelmed by the horror. We've got it 24 hours in our pocket, you know, on our phones. It's not as easy to get to shock people anymore, to you know, to show people something horrible, like children being starved to death in Yemen, and that they will get out there on the streets, demand policy change, and that it happens. I realized, you know, I wish I'd been a journalist back in the Pilger days, during the, you know, the 80s or the 90s, where, yes, it felt like you could garner much more attention for horror. These days, it just like people just...
Too much of it.
Too much, yeah.
I mean, looking, not superficially, but importantly at some of the things that happened along the way for you. You were nominated for a Walkley in 2015 for your Syrian refugee crisis reporting. And we haven't even mentioned that in 2010 you won a Walkley for your investigation of the killing of five children in Afghanistan by Australian Special Forces.
That was a really hard story because at the time Australian soldiers were still serving in Afghanistan. And
yes,
like these days, you know, Ben Robert Smith, that's a big... Everyone kind of knows about the allegations of war crimes by Australian soldiers. Back in 2010, no one was talking about it. And we were, you know, absolutely just, you know, the abuse that we received for doing that story was, yeah, horrendous. You know, we were, yeah, we had the Sydney shock jocks, yeah, personally kind of like yeah, slandering us because we dared to investigate this incident where Australian Special Forces in Oruzgan province had thrown a grenade into a housing compound and killed five children. And I actually ended up working with the ADF and giving them my footage because they didn't go and interview the family. We found the family, we interviewed them, we got their relatives to come to Kabul and talk to us, which like the ADF investigators didn't do. So we shared all this information. And as a result, you had two Australian soldiers charged with manslaughter, the first time this had happened since the Vietnam War. And unfortunately, those charges were dropped. It was found in the judge in the initial hearing said that the soldiers did not have a duty of care to protect those kids. Because what happened, they'd gone to the wrong compound. They were meant to go to one compound to find someone who's suspected of aiding the Taliban, and then no one was there. So then they made their own decision to go to this other compound without, and there was no, it wasn't based on any intelligence. So it was entirely reckless. And those manslaughter charges were justified because they had, there was no surveillance. They just decided on a whim. They were all fired up and wanted to raid a compound that night. The one that they were meant to go to, that they had got intelligence on, was empty. So then they just went to this other one and ended up killing five kids. So yeah, it was a really hard time doing that story, but it was the first Walkley I won. And
Sophie, around about that whole time you were reporting regularly from these war zones, you became a very familiar face on television. And people like me looked forward to seeing your report and hung on what you were telling us. But I don't think everyone in the country, from memory, was hanging on what you had to say. There was criticism. Was there a sense that you were, too close to the people against whom these wars were being fought? Did you ever get that sense that it was hard because some people were seeing you as more than a reporter?
I never hid my belief that, I was on one side. I was on the side of the civilians. I believe in international law, I will unashamedly say that, and that's probably why I left journalism, because I couldn't, I was against war crimes. I was against starving kids, I was against disproportionate bombing of civilian homes and targeting civilian infrastructure. And I realized that things are so dire these days with the climate emergency that we face and with the rise of authoritarianism and the breakdown of international law. It was time to say that, I am on one side. I'm on the side of civilians everywhere, And I used to sometimes get in trouble with my ABC producers because I would go out of my way to help people, because I had a lot of friends who'd also worked in conflict regions and did suffer from PTSD. There was always that, that kid you didn't help, or that, that person begging that you did this.
You walked
ignore.
On by.
Exactly. And I never did, because I knew that I couldn't live with it. So, if a family in the Yemeni hospital says our son's not going to get admitted to the, surgery unless we pay $20 US, I'm going to give them that $20 US. And I did. Or, we were on an island, we're on the Greek island of Lesbos during the Syrian refugee crisis, and I was there for 7:30 report to film it. This was an incredible summer. We had up to 20,000 people a day arriving on these Greek islands from Syria to make their way to Europe in the summer of 2016. And we were told to find a family and follow them. But when we arrived at this beach that morning, we found one old Syrian man by himself crying. And we're like, are you okay? I had my amazing producer and translator Fuad there with me. And this old man, his name was Nazir, he's like, I've lost my family. Like on the crossing, all he had on him was like 20 euros and his family Quran that he'd carried from Syria in a plastic bag and his walking stick. And so, I disobeyed my producer's orders, which was to find a family and follow them. We gave Nazir some water and food. We put him in our van, which the Greek authorities had outlawed. They, said you weren't allowed to help these people. And we just thought, stuff this. Like, this guy, poor bloke, can't walk. And we drove him to the Mytilene, the main town on Lesbos. And we, helped him try and find his family. And we put him in touch with the Red Cross. And, I just kind of just told my producers, you know, like we filmed the whole thing, so we got a great story out of it. And this is my argument, is that having a heart and doing the right thing actually gets you a better story, because it was a very...
The story changed.
Oh my God, it was an incredible story. Like we, and then, you know, we didn't find Aziz's family that day, but then I actually, again, told my producers one thing, took Nazir into Athens, connected him to the Red Cross. Me and Fuad had to go back to Jerusalem. Fuad tracked down Nazir's family on Facebook. We found them. They were in Germany, thought Nazir was dead. We then filmed the amazing reunification. So like, so if I just, I guess with my argument of like being a good person and putting your heart first and acting as a humanitarian, because that's always how I've acted, well, then you get the better story out of it. So I kind of, you know, that was my argument anyway. And I've got in trouble a lot.
Well, it sounds like the 14-year-old Sophie McNeil at Hollywood High School was still well and alive at this point. You mentioned already that in 2020, the ABC books published the book that you'd written, We Can't Say We Didn't Know, Dispatches from an Age of Impunity. But about the same time, you did leave journalism, more or less,
yeah.
and you joined Human Rights Watch.
Yeah.
And what were you thinking and what were you wanting to do?
I wanted to be on the right side of history. I wanted to stand for international law. You know, I'd just seen, I told you every story, I showed you everything. You know, kids starving, civilians being bombed, you know, the US carrying out reckless, horrific bombing campaigns in places like Raqqa and Mosul, where they did not take enough care to protect civilian lives, you know, as they tried to fight ISIS. I showed you when the Israelis did that. I showed you when the Saudis did that. I showed you when the Syrians did that. And like, nothing changed. And so I thought, I'm not going to still stay being a journalist and just showing you all this horror. I want to, you know, work on the solutions. And the only solution I could see was that we need international law to be upheld. We need strong global institutions. We need accountability. You know, we can't allow this kind of impunity. And that's what my book screamed. My book was like, please look at all this horror I've documented. If we don't actually end the impunity and, you know, demand accountability and hold governments to account, democratic and authoritarian governments, when they, you know, abuse civilians and massacre them, then this world is not going to be a nice place for our kids. And, you know, all of my fears have now come true in Gaza. Like, that is exactly what I was warning of. That kind of, you know, that this horror, this genocide. And so, yeah, I kind of quite bereft, absolutely bereft of what's happening in Gaza. And it's what I wanted to try and prevent. And yeah, it feels like, and I get emotional because
it's so terrible.
We you know, we for years I worked in Gaza since 2007, and we really showed everyone the horror of what Israel did to those people, and no one cared and no one paid attention, and our governments looked the other way, and that is what has empowered Israel to do what it is doing today, you know. So
Sophie,
it's the Gaza war that made me decide to go into politics, because I couldn't bear any more for this stuff to happen.
You have to do something. You took a diversion after Human Rights Watch, and you started worrying more directly about environment. You joined Greenpeace, and it's related, I can see, to human rights, because it's a human right to enjoy a clean environment. And I can imagine that a subtle change of scene would be a good thing at a personal level for you too.
Not really. I mean, for me, that, you know, the reason why I left Human Rights Watch to work, you know, to work on the climate crisis full time, is because I feel, you know, I know that if you really care about human rights and you want to stop suffering and you care about all of these things that I've worked on over the years, none of that will matter unless we get the climate crisis right, unless we prevent the mass suffering that will happen if we don't stop the burning of fossil fuels and urgently transition. And so for me, I just realized that the biggest human rights crisis is this one. This is the big one. And so all of these other issues, Palestine and Yemen and civilian suffering and refugees and all of these things are, you know, documented over the years, and see people have to flee their homes and not protect their children, you know, I knew that if we don't get this right, this is all of us. You know, it's not a hypothetical for me, these scenarios of what will happen with a warming planet. I've seen that suffering, and I I can see how clearly that we will get to that point if we don't urgently make these changes. And so it was just a bit of a no-brainer. You know, once I connected the dots and, you know, like I'd always known about it, but until I really sat down and, you know, one of the last stories I did for Four Corners when I worked at Four Corners was to go to the Brazilian Amazon and witness all of the destruction that was happening under the Bolsonaro government. And, you know, interview Brazilian climate scientists who were warning of the collapse of the Amazon if we didn't, you know, because even without the destruction of the rainforest, you know, just the warming temperatures could have the impact where it'll just be, you know, too dry for that ecosystem to survive. And I just realized, you know, it was actually at a climate rally in Sydney, and I brought my son Quinn at the time, who was only about six. And we were listening to all these stories that people talk about, you know, global warming. And Quinny was listening, and Quinn said to me, "We're going to fix this, aren't we, Mum? We're going to fix this." And I, you know, lied through my teeth and was like, of course, Quinn. Whereas inside I was like, God, I've got to, you know, this is it. This is the big one. Like, because I'd met all these parents in the Middle East who could never look their kids in the eye and promise them that they would be okay. Right? That's what all of that horror and that war did. Like, they just, you know, that tragedy of these parents not being able to protect their kids.
Couldn't be optimistic.
Well, they just couldn't protect them. And what that does to a parent, you know, you cannot guarantee your kid that they will be safe. And I realized that is us now with the climate emergency. That is all of us. And I could just relate to it so directly because of what I'd done in the Middle East. So it's the big one. We all need to work on it. And yeah, I just couldn't basically sleep at night unless I started working on it full time. So yeah, that was, yeah.
And so earlier this year, 2024, you nominated to stand for the a seat in the upper house of the West Australian Parliament for the Greens.
I did, yeah.
Did you have to linger long over making that decision?
So, you know, I think, like, I've been horrified at how Roger Cook has been continuing to push gas expansion, you know, new fossil fuel projects here. And I think not enough West Australians understand how complicit we are in the climate crisis. So West Australia produces 13% of the world's LNG, liquefied natural gas, which is, you know, like the new front line in kind of the climate wars, because, you know, coal is largely on the way out. Like, yes, we're still, like, Australia is the world's second largest exporter of brown coal, and it's horrific. It's quite difficult to get finance for new coal mines in Australia. But gas is positioning itself as a transition fuel, which is a total lie. You know, Woodside lies through, you know, Meg O'Neill and Woodside lies through their teeth every day telling us that we need more gas, whereas actually what we're doing is we're getting our neighbours in Asia addicted to more fossil fuels, and we're displacing renewables. You know, we're not displacing coal, we're displacing renewables. We need to urgently get off gas. You know, gas is as bad as coal. When you look at the methane emissions, it's absolutely horrific. And so the fact that my hometown, this place I love, that's always been my sanctuary, where I used to come back from the Middle East, you know, this place I adore. I mean, you know, I didn't need to go overseas to fight perpetrators and document abuses. Like, here is my beloved Western Australia supplying 13% of this deadly stuff that is causing this climate crisis, you know, and is now trying to produce more of it at a time when we know the facts, where we can see what we're doing. So it's just, yeah, to me, it's just like, it had to be done, you know, to stop, to try and stop new fossil fuel projects here in Western Australia, to stop the expansion of gas and to urgently transition. I see it as my best way of improving human rights globally, you know? Like, once you connect all the dots, it's very clear this is what we have to do, because, yeah, the consequences are already happening and they're terrifying. I mean, we've just had our hottest, driest summer ever, you know? We're seeing horrific scenarios in places like the Philippines and India with extreme heat, schools closing, you know, people dying in their hundreds in India because of the temperatures being so high. This week has been the hottest ever temperatures in Broome. It was 40 degrees in August. It's the dry season there. It's not meant to get anywhere near that hot. 40.02 degrees this week in Broome, hottest temperatures ever recorded. Like, it's happening, and here we have a state government that is ignoring all of the science and continuing to push for new gas. So I was outraged about that. And then the Labour Party policies at a federal level on Gaza, it was the final straw. I was like, yep, no, I'm going to politics. Because I've tried to change the world by telling stories they didn't listen. I tried to change it by working for human rights, watching Greenpeace and telling them what policies they should pursue, they didn't listen. So I realised, Michael, you just have to take their seats because these bastards don't listen. So that's now what I'm going to do.
The electoral system in Western Australia has been altered in recent times, how you get into Parliament and the size of the seats in the lower house and then the upper house. So tell listeners how you get elected to the upper house now if you're a Greens candidate.
Yes, so the rules have changed in Western Australia as of next state election, which is March 8, and our upper house at a state level will be more like the federal Senate, where you don't represent a certain area. So like right now we have one Greens MP in our state parliament, Brad Pettit, and Brad represents South Metro. But that will all be changed. You don't represent a certain area anymore. We will just represent Western Australia as a whole. And so for every 2.63% of the vote that the Greens get, we will get a member of the upper house. So we're hoping to get at least, you know, 4 or 5, maybe even 6 into the upper house, and we would love to have the balance of power to actually provide some kind of opposition. I mean, there's no opposition in this state. Like, it's just a joke, you know? Like, the Labour Party has had the biggest mandate ever, has had massive budget surpluses, and has done nothing to protect people's basic human rights in terms of, like, the housing crisis, in terms of kids dying in places like Berkshire Hill, and in terms of, you know, the climate crisis, which is the big one. So I just thought, if you really care about people's human rights, then, you know, the Greens are the only party that advocate and stand up for that and will defend everyone's human rights everywhere, from Gaza to a housing crisis in Perth where people can't even put a roof over their head, you know, to our First Nations kids who are suffering horrific experiences in our prison system at the moment, you know, to people in our region and our own kids who are going to experience the consequences of the climate crisis. So it really was a bit of a no-brainer once I've connected all the dots.
Well, my inquiries tell me that if you are number two on the Greens ticket, very good chance that you'll be elected to the upper house.
As the Arabs will say, inshallah. If God wills it to happen, it will happen, you know?
So, and
I'm not religious, but I love this Arabic term, inshallah. You say it for something that you hope will happen, that you wish will happen. So yes, okay. Inshallah, I will get into Parliament.
And your life could change again. I mean, you've seen politics close up and a bit further back and from this side and from that side and from up on top and a little underneath. Are you ready for it?
I wish the election was tomorrow. Yeah, I just can't wait to get in there and just try and change things. Like, it's just dire right now, absolutely dire. And what's really scary is, like, I've started looking at, you know, the bios of other, you know, people running and people who've been in the government for ages, and there's so many people who've, like, never had a real job. You know, they've only ever worked for the Labour Party or only ever worked for a politician. And it's just, you know, and how many of them are all, you know, there's not many millennials in Parliament, hardly anyone under 40. And so, yeah, I just think there is a desperate need for people of different experiences to get in there. And that's the great thing about our Greens ticket, is that we've got all these candidates of people who've got a lot of life experience, been to a lot of places, worked in a lot of different things, and will bring that into Parliament and try and, yeah, take back the power and give it to the people, and, you know, not work for Woodside as Cook and his cronies are doing at the moment. Like, they are endangering the future of our kids for, you know, the short-term profits of Woodside shareholders. It's so damaging.
So how does a number, let's say, the Dream, inshallah, of 6 Greens in the upper house after the next election in March happened, it becomes a numbers game, doesn't it?
Yeah.
If you don't have the numbers, how can politicians who think the way you've just been expressing it make a difference? How can they change the laws? How can they change what happens with the exporting of LNG to Asia and everywhere else?
Yeah, so at the moment, I think partly the reason the Labor Party is being so terrible is they just have no pressure to be any better. You know, we have absolutely hopeless media in this state. Like, you know, our only newspaper is run by a gas baron who, you know, wants new gas everywhere, loves putting Meg O'Neill on the front page, whinging about green tape. You know, Kerry Stokes and Seven West Media, they run Channel 7 News as well. So, yeah, it's pretty dire here. There's not many alternative voices that get heard. So, you know, we're building a movement of people. We're getting our message out through, you know, non-traditional means. And I think people are looking for alternatives. And so just having that power of an office, you know, you know, having our doors open to people like us who want to make the world a better place, and us being there to assist them and help, you know, whether it's movements to stop new fossil fuels or to end the war in Gaza or to end, you know, the overrepresentation of First Nations kids in our prison system, or, you know, to fix this housing crisis, which the two major parties have done nothing on. You know, no one is advocating for renters' rights or, to, you know, really to help first home buyers. All of those things, we will be there. We will be their allies in Parliament demanding. And even just that, I think that symbol of act of us being in Parliament and questioning Labor and highlighting how pathetic and hopeless they are on all of these issues is gonna help, I think, put massive pressure on them to be better. So, you know, we want to hold the balance of power. If we don't quite get there, just having us there, having an opposition, because it doesn't exist right now. So, you know, we will be the opposition, that's for sure. Because, I mean, you know, I'm not even going to bother talking about the Liberal Party.
Sophie, we're getting towards the end of our discussion. I can see it could go for the rest of the day. And I'm sure there'll be other occasions where we'll chat closer to the election, as Shipping News looks forward to doing with other candidates along the way. How does Sophie McNeill keep herself fit and well and happy while she engages in all of this political life? Do you get on a bike each morning and go for a ride? Do you go for a swim? Do you go for a jog? Do you just spend all the time getting the kids off to here and there? What happens?
Yeah, my kids are definitely better at sport than me. I'm a big fan of the treadmill and listening to music and kind of, you know, pounding the treadmill to focus my mind. But yeah, I guess, you know, I jump out of bed every morning wanting to make this world better. And it's, you know, I get messages from friends in Gaza every day. You know, I read the climate news every day. Like I'm, you know, it doesn't take much to motivate me, because I can see it and hear it and feel it everywhere I look. And I can also see how things can change. I can see the solutions, you know. It doesn't have to be this way. It's only this way because of the vested interests of a few and the kind of the uninspiring people who are in there because they like power. Like, I look at some of these members and their bias, and I'm like, why are you even there? Like, what have you ever done to kind of stand up for anything in your life? Like, it blows my mind. I just don't think we appreciate democracy enough in Australia. You know, I feel so lucky to be in a country where people, you know, they make fun of politicians. They make fun of, you know, elections. And it's like, fuck, man. Like, I've seen people risk their lives, like, die, be, you know, kidnapped and tortured in Syria because they, you know, all they wanted was the right to vote, you know? And so I really appreciate the system we have. I've decided it's time to get involved. And, yeah, I think it's time for all of us. Like, I've seen people take such courageous steps to stand up and be on the right side of history, you know, to do the right things for their country, for their kids. And I just think if only we had a bit of that courage that I saw people in the Middle East, you know, have every day in their lives. And we just here, I think, forget how lucky we are, and we just, you know, close our eyes and look the other way. But yeah, I'm just constantly inspired by the people I met over there who, yeah, were just so brave. And I just think we all just need to be a little bit braver and stand up and do the right thing, because I just, you know I want to be able to look my kids in the eye and tell them, you know, in 20 years, if we don't get this climate crisis right, I want to be able to tell them I did everything I could, you know. Sophie, and we're all going to have to do that. And so, I just hope that along the way I bring a few more people on the journey. And the, you know, the Greens is a wonderful movement. Anyone can join. You know, I'd love to work with anyone. Come out door knocking with me and come out campaigning, stop bloody Woodside, and have a bit of fun along the way, because you have to have fun. They can't take that, you know.
Sophie McNeill, it's been lovely talking to you. Thank you for joining me today, telling us a little bit about your life, how you got to where you are now. And we wish you well for the next stage of your career.
Thank you so much.